Hemingway's The Old Man and the Sea, the only thing he thought about other than fishing was baseball. So Cubans want a special relationship with the United States, and they're like cousins, close cousins, who feel that the United States has turned its back on them. So that creates a lot of resentment, and yet at the same time they want to be loved. They're very warm people, when you travel there, especially if you speak Spanish, you know, you quickly are treated like an hermano, you know, right away. When they know you're American, they treat you well, although always with caution at the same time, because there's actually a law in Cuba that says Cubans can be arrested for socializing with foreigners. This was aimed at trying to keep Cubans from becoming too close to American or foreign journalists who were based there, and getting views of unhappy, I guess, discontent that would be reflected in the reporting. There are a lot of contradictions in Cuba. I wanted to explain why Cuba has been this conflictive relationship with the United States going back years. And of course, when Castro came to power in 1959, New Year's Day of 1959, he was already radical, and may or may not have been a communist at that time. His brother, I think, was more closely linked to the communist, what's Cuba version of the Communist Party. But the Eisenhower administration's reaction to his first measures, including confiscation of American properties there, radicalized him further. So there was no question he was going to seek the help of a power like the Soviet Union that would counterbalance the pressures he was getting from the U.S. Some historians think that the United States could have kept that from happening if they had played their cards differently. But, you know, the Eisenhower administration was not going to, it took a hard line. There are a lot of contradictions in Cuban society. It's a country whose leaders have fought hard to turn it into an ideal of pure socialism, only to see most Cubans spend their waking hours trying to get their hands on the Yankee dollar due to its huge purchasing power in Cuba's tightly controlled economy. There are several anecdotes I remember that illustrated this. Right now, when the Soviet Union collapsed in the 90s, Cuba was sort of left to fend for itself. It no longer had the strong subsidies. And one of the things it opened up its doors to tourism and to investment from European and Canadian companies in tourism. They came in and started managing big hotels and sharing. I mean, property was always in the ownership of the government, but it started creating lots of jobs in tourism. Cubans, all would if they could, would likely be working in the tourism industry, because a dollar has such incredible purchasing power for example, two anecdotes. One evening when we were there, we walked out and walked down to a little plaza where there was an outdoor cafe, and we sat down. I had a beer, and you have to pay in dollars in this kind of situations. I think the beer was a couple dollars, and so I left a dollar tip for the waitress, and she almost cried. She said, "Señor, you don't know what this dollar means to me." She said, "I make $6 a month," and they do get subsidized some food, not much. You get like rice, sugar, salt, pasta, some things like that. But it's not a balanced diet, and they have to try to then acquire extras with their own money. And so another anecdote that I remember very much that struck in my mind, we had a cab driver for half a day while we were there. I was there with my wife, Sandra, and became pretty good friends with him and talked very openly. He was a retired Army, I think, major or Air Force major who actually studied in Canada to become learn more about aviation mechanics and stuff. And he'd had a very successful career in the Army. He was retired fairly young. And he had a pension of $300. Now, that is a fortune in Cuba, but at the same time, he was allowed to have a cab and charge in dollars to foreigners. And he said he was making at least easily that much more as a cab driver. And so he lived very well. He was a big fan of the revolution, and he, as we talked, he explained about he had two twin sons. And he was very proud of them because one was a medical doctor and one was a nuclear physicist. And he said, my sons could have never dreamed of acquiring this level of education under the old regime. And as it was, our Cuban Revolution allowed them to attain this, this educational achievement. And I said, we talked a little bit, and I said, where do they live here in Havana? He said, well, they live with me in my house. They can't afford to have their own homes. So here there are these highly educated people who knows what they're making, maybe $10, $15 a month, because humans are not rewarded with economic, it's a very pure socialist model. You do not get your reward from financial means. You get it from contributing to society. And this is one of the things that they have trouble with now, after 50 years after the revolution, that the younger generations don't feel that revolutionary fervor, and one of the things that that is a problem for them, of course, they don't like Cubans having access to the kind of knowing about the lifestyles of Cubans who left Cuba living in Miami. Of course, they all know about it. But it's something that younger Cubans obviously think about a lot. How, if they were in Miami or someplace, with this kind of education, what they could enjoy in means of consumer things. And so anyhow, there's that part of Cuba. The other contradictions are. But one thing I want to make clear is people, for a long time U.S. governments thought, Cuba is ready to explode. That's how they got the Bay of Pigs, thinking that we just sent supported these Cuban exiles, the regime will collapse. As it turns out, most Cubans have great affection and respect for Fidel Castro. They see him as a father figure. I don't think it's a false, any kind of false idea that communicated about him. Raul, who took over when the days were ending the government in 2006 after Fidel fell ill, although Fidel is still a moral force in the background, is not charismatic, more pragmatic, in some ways a mixture of more of a hardliner, but also pragmatic in line certain examples of small enterprises to develop that kit. Fidel, was more ideological pure and resisted for a long time. But they are proud of the revolution and really fondness for Fidel. One of the things that you first notice when you go to Havana is that there's no commercial propaganda. And when you're in the United States, you're bombarded with it, and it's so strange. The only other place I saw this was Nicaragua during the time the Sandinistas were in power, too. You saw it. Almost no commercial propaganda, but you see political propaganda every place about the revolution. You're inundated with it, and big billboards and sayings, Fidel sayings on walls, and of course on the television. It's only state television, but they are for example, there was a woman when we were walking around one day. She was sitting on the stoop of a little alleyway near the downtown, selling some arts and crafts, I think some embroidered things. The fan was looking at them. We started talking to her, and she invited us back to her home. Her home was down the alleyway, just a few steps, in one room. It came in. It was just a room that was probably from the sound equipment over to the end of the stable back. And in that room, she lived with her two teenage sons. and it was all crammed up with the few material possessions they belonged. And she was a fervent supporter of Fidel and revolution because her two sons were on the Cuban Olympics team, and they'd done well. And she was just, you know, they looked very poorly, but she was so proud of them. And so it's a big mistake if the U.S. government would think that there's not support for the Cuban regime. But there's many negative things about the Cuban regime. I don't want to sound like I'm defending it because it's brutal and it's repression by sin and feels threatened and have periodic crackdowns and just for, you know, expressing an opinion, basically, not for taking any kind of actions. When I was there, someone told me that, and this is really what a way of controlling the population. There are dissenters. There are people that protest in the streets from time to time. They're usually shouted down by organized pro-government protesters, and some of them go on the web and actually put out, you know, critical views of the regime. But the regime is capable of expelling the students who are, I'm talking about 7, 8, 9 year old kids who are sons and daughters of dissenters. They just kick them out of school. They have no education. You know, that's a very effective way of controlling, you know, people. When you throw them, they're going to lose their education. Now, one of the things that Cuba is proud of is that they have medical care. I mean, first of all, they have a high literacy. It's the most literate country. They have a very low rate of literacy. And they also have the poor have access to medical care, unlike most of Latin American countries where if it is available, it's not available to everybody. It's really poor. Cuba has a high level of medical services, but Cuba also, one of the things it does is it's this high quality medical system. They use it for propaganda purposes. Latin Americans, especially leftists, travel to Cuba a lot to get medical treatment, and they receive first-class medical treatment. But the local Cubans, although it's available, you know, to them, there are restrictions. A Peruvian journal, in fact, when I was living in Lima, we had lunch one day, and she was telling me about her visit to Cuba, and she had the day before she was supposed to leave, she became ill, and she spent all her money. She had no money to go to the doctors that see foreigners who charge a lot. If you go to see a Cuban doctor, they're going to charge you because all this is set up to gain dollars from people. The same way, I digress, but when you go to hotels, the big hotels, everything is very pricey in dollars. This is the way the government's trying to replace the income from the Soviet Union with this really expensive tourism, dollar tourism. Well, she said she had a Cuban friend who said, well, I'll take you to the local clinic. You just try to not say much. And maybe she won't recognize your Peruvian accent. She'll treat you. And so they took her down to the local clinic. The local clinic was just a little hole in the wall with two rooms. You walked in. It was a bench out front and an examination table in the back behind some curtains that were sort of dirty, and there was a young woman doctor in there, and she examined her. I'm not sure whether she realized she was Peruvian or not. She probably did, but she played along with it, and she told that she had some gastric infection, but she said, I really don't have medicine to give you. We don't have medicine. I can diagnose what your problem is. We just don't have the medicine to give you. So I'm assuming this Cuban would have had the same problem. But it's not exactly related to the medical part of it, but just to show you the level of hardship of Cubans, during the time she was there waiting to be treated, a guy comes in with a basket, and a little towel over his basket, and he comes up to the woman doctor, lifts the towel, takes out two cold biscuits and puts them on a napkin on her table and leaves. And the woman doctor says, It's a government doctor, they're all government doctors. This is my dinner for tonight. You know? So the Cuba medical system, which is, you know, brings great pride to Cuba because it treats it's highly advanced in treatment of cancer and cardiac problems and things. At the same time, it does not, it's not capable of providing the kind of care its population really needs. Now, you'll hear things like, one time we were at a street market and we were talking to some, Cubans are very open, you know, in many ways. They're very warm, and like the Peruvians where we lived for so many years, we're very reserved. Cubans are almost a stereotype, friendly. So we got into a conversation with one of the vendors in the street market. She was selling, I think, some kind of little doll she had made. And right away, she jumped on me. Because of you Americans, we don't have toilet paper and pens. Because we have marble. Like, why do you treat us like this? You know, we like Americans. And I said, well, why don't you buy them from Italy or England? She was speechless, you know. I don't know, you know. I mean, you can buy them from, you know, you don't have to go, okay, the Americans aren't allowed to sell you this stuff, but, you know. Obviously, the reason is that the Cuban government does not have enough hard currency reserves. That's why it opened up historically in the 90s to tourism. It needs to get dollars to import things, and of course it doesn't happen. But that was the brainwashing that goes on in Cuba. It is, I mean, people are bombarded with this message that the United States is the cause of all of its economic problems. That's why the embargo is really stupid. If they took away the embargo, the Cuban government would have no one to blame for anything. And it's one of the most stupid policies. And I'm disappointed that the Obama regime it did not carry through harder in trying to get that change. Of course, it's a congressional law, and it's not easy. But it allows the Cuban government an easy out of why it can't supply its own population with basic things. I'm going through this faster than actually I plan to talk a lot more about things. When you're in Cuba, you sense a mood of waiting among the Cuban people. It's almost palpable. All Cuba is waiting in a mixture of anticipation, excitement, and even fear to see what happens when Fidel and Raul are gone. Cubans know change is coming. Fidel is 83. He almost died in 2006 from surgery for some kind of undisclosed digestive problem. And was forced to step aside and turn day-to-day power over to Raul, who is 77 and is rumored to be an alcoholic and not in good health himself. The rest of the Cuban leadership is this gray bureaucrats. None of them obviously would be able to hold Cuba together when the Castros are gone. Cubans are waiting, and you can feel it, you know, that they know something's going to happen. And these two old men and no one else who have any leadership abilities. So what will happen when the Castros are gone? Well, no one can be certain. They'll try to, the younger leaders in government will probably try to hold it together. As much as they can, but it probably there will be some kind of a collapse of some kind. One of the things that may happen was it was interesting. Just a few weeks ago, a very distinguished and respected Cuban intellectual on a state website, and this is a guy who just a few days before had praised the government for something, was allowed. Put out an analysis of his concerns about what could happen after the Castros are gone, and what he said was there's a great possibility that Cuban officials already are planning to try to divide up the spoils when Cuba's political system collapses, like the shadowy oligarchs who emerged from the collapse of the Soviet Union in the 1990s. In other words, there's not going to be an attempt to really retain a social system. They're all going to try to get a piece of the pie and somehow hold on to it and turn it over and let somehow a political change take place. But it's a very corruption, according to this intellectual, is at the highest level of the government, is the greatest threat to Cuba's communist system, not a political dissent. It's corruption. Apparently, it's deep-seated, widespread, and these high officials will just try to hold on to properties and other kinds of things that would, you know, so they can live the good life. This happened. I saw this happen. It's sort of ironic in Nicaragua when I was covering Nicaragua in the early 80s. The Sandinistas, who came in as revolutionaries with the support of the Castro government, at the same time they had a revolutionary rhetoric. Daniel Ortega, who was the president of the country, he confiscated one whole block of mansions and made it his compound when the Somoza's people fled the country. So he had something like 10 houses that were his. And he kept those houses when he left power. Borja, another who was the defense minister in the Sandinista government, he took over a very popular restaurant that had been owned by some Somocista, and one time was really upset because they had some road crew had sort of blocked off the restaurant to repair the road, and he became out enraged when he heard about it. He drove out there with his crew, you know, his couple of jeeps of his men, and just took axes and chopped out the blocks of wood that were blocking people from getting into his restaurant. And he was one of the most hardline revolutionaries. So I imagine what this academic is saying is true. After 50 years in power, a lot of these guys, especially the younger members of the Cuban government, are no longer very fervent revolutionaries. They're waiting for an opportunity to like you say, divide up spoils benefit when Castro and his brother are gone, because they probably know that there's nobody capable of holding the regime together, because Castro is beloved by the Cuban people. They see him as sort of a big brother who stood up to Uncle Sam, and when Uncle Sam was supporting a very brutal Batista dictatorship, and people, Cubans, were embarrassed by Cuba during the Batista dictatorship. I mean, it was such a corrupt thing, and I mean, it was the poorhouse of the Caribbean. Men traveled to Cuba, you know, because everybody seemed like it was on the street prostituting herself. And mafia, there's one hotel in that they refurbished with one of the foreign investors, and it was the hotel hangout of the American mafia. And it's fascinating. You go in there, on the walls of the hallway, they have the pictures of all the famous mafiosa types and parties and things, and you can see, you know, how that would come there. And, so that kind of thing embarrassed Cubans. And again, it was the sort of thing that, and the United States supported the Batista regime for 25 years because he was their man. And he didn't, you know, he towed the line, and that was what the United States cared about. And the Cubans, as I said, always have this love-hate relationship. They somehow felt they deserved better from the U.S. government, and they did. But the Cubans, given, you know, half a chance, would be so friendly to Americans. So it's going to be very important how the United States reacts when the regime collapses. Something else I think is going to happen, I haven't read about this, but I think it will happen. The Gusanos, those are the Cubans who fled Cuba after Castro came to power. That's what the Cuban regime called them, the worms, the Gusanos, the worms. They're made up mostly of middle-class and upper-class Cubans who, it's interesting, are white. If you've been to Cuba, if you've been to Miami, you'll find Cubans there are white. You go to Havana and you think, is this the same country? Except for the leadership, which is white. all of Havana is practically black or mulatto. So you have a racially divided society. The middle and upper class were white. The working class was black or mulatto. Out in the islands, you do find towns where you have more of a less of a black population, but still basically Cubans are heavily mixed because it was black slavery was widespread there at one time. And anyhow, I think what's going to happen is the middle and upper classes who fled Cuba, these white people are going to flock back to Cuba and try to reclaim property they lost half a century ago. They're going to try to seek to expel hundreds of thousands of squatters in these buildings because the Cuban government does not have the money to provide housing, so they allowed squatting to take place. And some of these buildings are incredible, beautiful old mansions, but if you look inside them, it's a tropical place. You can sort of, the lobby will be open, you look inside and you see things like the side one wall will have all kinds of strange electrical wiring running because there might be 12 families living in this building. And water seeping down through the walls. And this is the housing that exists. And every once in a while, you'll drive along a beautiful old street, old homes, and see a vacant lot. And the cab driver said, oh, that's where our building fell down last year. These buildings all collapsed. There's no maintenance because the Cuban government will not allow anybody to invest money in these buildings because it's owned by the state. And so people aren't going to do it on their own either. If they can't have some kind of claim to owning it, they don't want to invest in it. So Cuba's fill, and Havana's is a beautiful city. Its architecture goes back to maybe the late 1800s or early 1900s. There's a small colonial area, Spanish colonial area, but it's more like something like New Orleans architecture. And it's just rotted out. But It's still one of the most beautiful cities in the Americas, and if they were smart, when the regime collapses, government comes apart, they will not allow those buildings to be torn down, but will demand whoever takes control of them, you know, that refurbish and restore them, because it will be like the Paris of the Americas. But I foresee what happening, all these people of mine coming in, wanting to tear down these buildings, build, you know, skyscrapers, the building ugly because they'll think it's cheaper. And it will destroy Havana, but in addition to destroying the beauty of it, this flopping back of these Cubans who have fled the country and trying to receive their property is going to set off a violent conflict because people, hundreds of thousands of people, have no homes, and if some kind of government comes to power and allows people to lay claims to property or haciendas or all kinds of things. There will be chaos in Cuba, and there will be a long period of conflict. And so when the Castros are gone, instead of their peace returning to the country, it will probably be a lot of conflict and violence for many years.
Everything that Monty said is true. I noticed until a little while ago nobody wanted to sit in the front row, so apparently you all think this is a college class.
You're gonna
there will be no quiz, so you can all relax. I want to start off by showing you where we went in Cuba. I'm going to use Don as my bulletin board. I realize you can't see the details, but if you can see the broad outlines, this is the island of Cuba. This is the city of Havana, which is almost directly south, 90 miles from Key West. This is the city of Cienfuegos, and this is the city of Santa Clara. Those are the three places we visited. And all the way over here is Guantanamo, where the U.S. Naval Base is located. Thanks, Don. Well, Batista left in 1959, and not only were the Cubans thrilled about it, but everybody, I remember everybody in the United States was too. I was reading the New York Times then, and it was a cause of jubilation. Just to give you an idea of why everybody hated Batista so much. When journalists wrote things that were critical, or when people attempted to mount some sort of political opposition, their body parts were found floating in Havana Bay shortly thereafter. So the response of the Batista government to that was to ban fishing in Havana Bay. I can't say for sure that that story is true, but that's one of the things that our guide, our Cuban guide, told us. However, things went downhill rapidly after that, and Castro refused to hold elections and declared a communist government, seized properties, especially American properties, and the American embargo was imposed in 1962, and as Monty indicated, that has been the overwhelming factor in Cuban-American relations since then. And of course, in order to go there, you need some kind of gimmick. If you're an American citizen, you're banned from going to Cuba, but the State Department will give you a license for some sort of cultural exchange. So you need a hook, and our hook was, it was a religious mission to the tiny Jewish community of Cuba. And so Cuba itself is a police state, but it's not like the KGB in the old USSR. It's an open feeling. People talk. They don't like to talk too much, and they make sure that you understand that you shouldn't repeat it. Certainly, our guy told us, don't send me any emails repeating what I said. as long as it's not in writing or on the internet, he felt free to criticize the government quite liberally. However, it is a controlled information situation. No satellites, no foreign sources. There are two TV stations and two newspapers, both controlled by the government. As Monty indicated, if you're a student, in most countries the students are the revolutionaries and they have riots on the campuses, but that doesn't happen in Cuba because you get thrown out of school, and so all possibility of having even what passes for a good life in Cuba is lost, so the students know which side their bread is buttered on. Okay, some facts. The population is 11.2 million. 75% of them live in an urban setting. The Cuban Revolution has done some terrific things, let's be honest. The infant mortality rate is by far the lowest in Central and South America. The life expectancy is by far the best in that part of the country. Adult literacy is 97%, which is well above the average for that part of the world. Youth literacy is 98%, which is also well above. And Cuba did pretty well economically during the years of Russian support, but that totally collapsed after the Soviet Union collapsed and just simply pulled out. I mean, there's a great, big, huge Russian embassy building, which, as far as I know, is empty. It's also the ugliest building in Havana. So they used to get petroleum and pharmaceuticals from the Soviet Union because they couldn't get them from their natural source, which geographically would have been the United States. So now they're very short on petroleum and extremely short on medicine. For a long time during the Soviet cooperation era, there was no tourism. Castro didn't want Cubans hearing about how great life was in Miami for the exiles. But out of desperation, they now allow tourism. But the economy has changed. The number one industry is tourism. The number two industry is nickel. Tobacco is number three. Sugar now, which used to be the staple of their economy, is way, way down. And one of the reasons I'm told for that is that the machinery for harvesting sugar cane is falling into disrepair, and so production has fallen by 50%. And by the way, as a tourist, one of the neatest things was, there was my old 1955 Chevy that I had when I was a law student. And all over the streets of Havana and other cities, you see these ancient American cars, some of them falling apart, but many of them lovingly maintained and shined and polished. And it was like stepping back into an old Hollywood movie or a time warp of some kind. And being a guy who was interested in cars, I just loved it. But they're starting to import Chinese cars, and those, I don't know how well they run, but they look pretty slick. There's full employment in Cuba. There's a job for everybody. There is, however, a maximum 4-to-1 ratio between the highest and the lowest salaries. You can be the most important guy in the country, but you only make $40 a month, and the poorest guy in the country makes $10 a month, and that's it. Now, in addition to that, they have your food rations that you don't have to pay for, and education is absolutely free through the highest levels, and medical care is absolutely free. So the idea is that your income should not have to pay for these things. As I said, there was no tourism during the Russian support years, but then when the Russians pulled out, the Castro government was forced to allow tourism, and that is now by far the most lucrative industry, and everybody wants to work in tourism. Our guide was an electronic engineer, and obviously a very bright guy, and his English was pretty darn good. Not idiomatic, but good. And he made far more money as a tour guide than he could ever make as an electronic engineer. So you heard about doctors and nuclear physicists having to live at home. That's how it works. The tips that you leave in a hotel is more than a doctor can make in a month working in a hospital. However, recently, there has been some relaxation. Some small private businesses are allowed, but only in your own home. So they now have what they call paladores, which are restaurants. The only restaurants that are not owned, every business except for these home things is owned by the government. So now, in addition to the government-owned restaurants, which are not bad at all, you can have these little home restaurants. In other words, mama cooks, and there's a limit on how many people that she can have, but that's not tightly observed.
And you eat in their living room, right?
Basically. Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. A veterinarian can have a private practice in his garage. And they've recently denationalized beauty salons and barbershops. So personal service businesses have begun to be allowed on just a very private basis. For the first time, joint investments are being encouraged with foreign countries. The largest investments are, if I can get this page to turn, Canada, Israel, and France, which is interesting because Cuba does not have official relations with Israel, but unofficially there's a lot going on between them. The foreign investor typically owns 50% of the company, and the Cuban government owns the other 50%. As I said, there's full employment, but the black market and prostitution are available because obviously those, like the tourist trade, are things where you can make a lot more money outside the system. And Monty told you about the Meyer Lansky Hotel. Mm-hmm. It was just around the corner from where we were staying. So another old codger and like me went with me. We took a walk and went over and looked around the Meyer Lansky Hotel. And when we came out, there were two very attractive young ladies wearing very tight clothing who offered to spend the rest of the evening with us. So we had a confirmation that
process.
Tell
me about that.
I knew I'd put my foot in my mouth if I saw it.
Let me just add in there one about prostitution too, because that's something that the Castro regime supposedly eliminated, right? One the hotel we're staying in, I went down the lobby one evening by myself to get something at the cafe, and immediately several attractive young women came right up to me like that, you know. So it's ironic. One of the things that supposedly goaded Cubans into having the revolution was to get rid of prostitution. It's just still there, more hidden, more subtle in it.
Yeah, so. All I can say, Monty, is that you're a chick magnet. All right. Basic food supplies are rationed. You have a ration card, but it's free. Your monthly supply is 6 pounds of rice, 6 pounds of sugar, 1 pound of salt, and 4 gallons of oil. There's a liter of milk a day for children up to age 7. But then there are farmers markets, again, private economy, and you can buy things there if you have the cash, relatively inexpensively without using your ration card. Housing, 70% of it is privately owned, and in addition to old cars, one of the things I'm interested in is architecture. Well, it can break your heart. You drive around Havana, and you see this magnificent old buildings, describing it as the Paris of Latin America. I've never been to Buenos Aires, so I don't know, but it really was a gorgeous, gorgeous city, but only for the rich. And now those buildings are occupied by squatters, and they're falling apart, but they're fully occupied. You may have five families in what was a mansion for one rich family before the revolution. However, and Monty didn't mention this because he hasn't been there recently, the Cuban government is beginning to realize what a treasure it has there. And of course, I'm sure this is fueled by the recently opened tourist trade, well, recently in the last few years. So they are slowly, little by little, restoring these buildings, and they are doing a good job of it. We saw some of the restored buildings, and they have been restored to their former magnificence. And I think someday, in the not too distant future, Havana will be beautiful again. It really is a magnificent city. Education, universal, free for all up to age 15. If you can pass the exams, you can continue your free education to the university level. Education is not bad. However, Marxism-Leninism is a required course for all. And English is taught for everybody as a second language starting at 8 years of age. They do have sophisticated computers and technology, but you can't have an individual computer. You can't have access to the web. But if you go into a... Internet cafes, but all the hotels have internet. It's kind of expensive, but if you have the cash, and of course the tourists can do email, but you cannot go, even the tourists cannot go on the web. They obviously want information about the outside world, the capitalist world, kept out. Universal free health care, clinics in all neighborhoods, but no medicines. One of the things that we were encouraged to do and did to the extent we were able was to bring pharmaceuticals to these synagogues that we visited in those cities that I pointed out to you. Some of the larger synagogues, and there were two in Havana that were large enough to do this, they had their own clinics and their own pharmaceuticals. And was it a well-stocked drugstore? No, they just had whatever the tourists brought. And if you were lucky, the disease you got matched the pharmaceuticals they had. If not, too bad. However, as Monty said, there is a separate medical system for foreigners who get the very best care. On the other hand, the care that the natives get is probably better than what they were able to get before Castro. Mm-hmm. Abortion is available on demand. Alcoholism is a big problem. Racism. Everything is legally equal, but if you take a close look, the universities are 70% white, 30% black, whereas the population at large is 70% black.
And I think the leadership is almost all white, too, when you look at them. You just don't see blacks among the leadership.
And the jail population is 90% black, is the figure that I got. Absolutely no anti-Semitism in Cuba. All religions were suppressed until the late 1990s when Castro, this was still Fidel, had a change of heart and invited the Pope to visit, and after that all religious practices were allowed again. So this tiny Jewish community actually carries on the practice of their faith. There are no rabbis. They have a rabbi who visits Cuba once. I have it down here. I'll come to it in a minute. Okay, no TV. All TV is government stations. No internet except email. Very low rate of infant mortality. High literacy. I guess I said that. Longevity. The people are very friendly, very open. And that's it for my factual summary. I'll tell you a little bit about the religious mission. Before 1959, there were 15,000 Jews in Cuba, and when things turned communist, 90% of them left. So there's only 1,300 Jews left out of a total population of over 11 million. The Jewish religion is treated like any other. There's a general disdain for religion in general, but it isn't directed toward any one religion. The big thing about Cuba is the lack of incentive to work. Those who can, like our guide, go into the tourist industry where they can make more money, but still, obviously, these are very talented people, and some of them could be much wealthier if left to their own devices. Exit visas are rarely given, but Jews are allowed to emigrate to Israel. That's one outstanding exception. Tourism, people coming from the outside into Cuba, was forbidden until the Soviet Union broke up, and then they needed the hard currency. And now, as I said, it's a major source of income for Cuba. So that's all I have.
Well, they do have income from tourism. They make a lot of money from tourism. As Lou said, it's joint ventures. The hotels, for example, are still owned by the government, but they have management companies and they split the profits. And most of them are fairly expensive to stay in. They have hard currency from nickel exportations and things like that. But they don't have enough. Yes, and that's the problem. The standard of living in general is not high, but they do have good education and basic health care. But you find people don't have much material possession. You find Cubans, most of the people in Havana are poorish, wearing obviously donated clothing because they wear the oddest assortment of clothing sometimes. And so it must be stuff sent by relatives from Miami and things. The living standard isn't high. You know.
When I came back, I said, communism is not sharing the wealth, it's sharing the poverty. Mm-hmm. And one more thing, the people who do have these private incomes, the veterinarian in the garage and the Palidores restaurants and so on, they pay income taxes to the government. Someone want to... Okay, just go ahead. A lot. It's a major source. And by the way, one thing I forgot to say was, we flew back from Havana to Miami. We got off the plane, and it was like we never left. Every face was Cuban. Everybody was speaking Spanish, and you had to be told that you weren't still in Havana. In March. For 8 days. Yes.
In the last few weeks, the Obama administration allowed one of the major oil companies, Exxon, to do a joint venture with the Cuban government for the exploration of oil. Are you familiar with this?
Maybe they're hoping to spring another leak in all the shores of Cuba.
I'm not familiar with what's going on there, really. I know maybe that's an effort by Obama to get around the restrictions. I'm not sure how he's doing it, really, because according to the law, I didn't think you could do that. And the law is a law set by Congress, so I think the administration has to a certain degree, has its hands locked and being more flexible. But obviously, they've found some way of, I think, getting around it.
In today's paper, Sarasota Herald Tribune, there was an item that there were low-level consultations between the Cuban and American governments about the oil spill and the fact that some of this stuff may drift toward Key West and Cuba.
I just want to add, I think I mentioned it, but I think that is a terribly stupid policy of the embargo because it plays into the hands of the Cuban government. Except for the need for tourism now, I mean, it always tried to isolate the Cuban population from what was going on outside so they would not realize how their standard of living was so low compared to, you know, Cubans and who left the country. And it just, they blame everything on the embargo. Everything that's wrong with the economy is because of the American embargo. And that, if you took that away, they'd really have problems. And the worst thing that happened to Cuba, I think, is a flood of American tourists going in there, you know, being American tourists, displaying their wealth and stuff, talking to Cubans, and it would bring money in, because that's the idea, is, but it would undercut the support for the La Revolucion tremendously.
Our tour guide was very explicit in expressing the opinion that the American embargo is very important to the Castro brothers in sustaining.
He said that.
Yes,
wow.
He said that. Sustaining the level of revolutionary fervor that they want to sustain in Cuba. So it does appear, anecdotally at least, that if the embargo were lifted, it would tend to undercut the communist regime. The streets seem to be very safe. We walked around at night and were not worried. I don't know what the hotel rooms cost, because it was, you know, we paid with one big check up front.
Well, from what I understand, hotel rooms are, these are the nice, there's some very nice hotels that have been restored, beautiful hotels. And there, I think the rates are $250, $300 a night. There are some smaller hotels. We stayed in a small hotel, and that was about $50 a night. It was the kind of place that tourists wouldn't normally stay in. We spoke Spanish, and it was down way away from the tourist area. There aren't very many of those, because the whole idea is to really soak the wealthy tourists. I mean, they need those dollars. You go into government restaurants, it's going to cost you $30. For a meal. You go to these paladares and those homes, you probably eat for $6 or $7. It's simple food, fried fish, rice and beans, maybe a little salad. But I was going to mention on the paladares, when we went out to a town called Trinidad, which is out along the coast, it's beautiful. It's like it's like a small town village that is trapped in time. It's other things, red tile roof on rolling hills and the sea beneath you. And it's a place where a lot of tourists go, European tourists. And there, people are allowed to have hostels in their homes. And for some reason, they allow a certain kind of ownership of homes that apparently outside of Havana, more where there's not so much squatting. That we ended up staying in two different places, and their homes were they could the descendants could inherit the home from the previous generation. And so it was, even though they couldn't sell the property, they could remain in it. And yeah, they were allowed, turned at several, we stayed at several places that had turned the property into hostels. But it's interesting because they can provide meals. And one of the things, the first place we were staying at, and it's amazing, they give us so much food, we're paying like $6 or $7, and we walk back into the kitchen, we ate in the kitchen, and the whole table was filled with all kinds of food, and every night we had lobster, and that was illegal, because lobster is supposed to be sold as a controlled product, it's supposed to be sold to the big hotel, through the big hotels, $40, $50 a night maybe. We were getting it as part of a meal of $6 or $7. I was sick, I guess it's incredible, I was sick of lobster after a while. But I mean, I don't want any more lobster. Because they were trying to please us. They were going, we got you some lobster, senor, you know. And that was the enterprise of these Cubans who were trying to make a little bit of money, and they wanted to provide a good service, and they were taking a chance doing it.
Our heart goes out to you, Mother. I might add that you talk about the squatters. In many instances, what happened was the wealthy family fled their mansion, and the servants who were working in that building took over, and they and their descendants are living in mm-hmm. that mansion.
But quite crammed, as you said. Quite, I mean, very. I mean, lots of people living in these homes.
Speaking of squatters, you talked about the restoration of the building. Were you talking about the mansions where there are these squatters?
Yes.
If so,
Among others, yes.
Well, what happens to the squatters? When I was there, what they were restoring were the Spanish colonial era buildings. Have they started restoring some of those buildings that look more like New Orleans type buildings as well? Because that huge, Havana is, it's a big city, and there's a huge area of the city that has this kind of architecture. It's all run down and decrepit. And what I saw that when I was there, they were restoring pockets towards the center of the town where they had the colonial architecture. But I don't know about stirring these guys, because the question is, where are they going to put these people? And I don't think, the ones that I saw restored must have had, I suppose, squatters in them at one time, but they weren't the kind of buildings that people were living in now. There were these stone buildings, looked like from the Spanish colonial era. Maybe they'd been offices at one time or something. But I don't know what you know about it, but I often wonder myself, what are they going to do with these people who try to restore these buildings, especially if the regime falls and people come back and they want to, invest in real estate and things. I think there'll be a huge social problem because basically the Cuban regime did not build public housing. There's some public housing projects outside of Havana, but not many, and they say they don't have the money to do it.
I'm going to call on Ellie to restore myself to her good graces after consorting with prostitutes.
A couple things. The trip is very expensive. It was $4,000 a day, $1,200 a day.
Wow.
And they traveled on a charter. And they had to bring in, and it's $150 to the Jewish community for the next city, and they had to bring 15 pounds.
One of the humanistic Jewish congregations in Florida, this one, not the one here, but the one on the East Coast, arranged a license through a tourist agency that specializes in licensed travel to Cuba. I don't know what that's all they do, but they specialize in that, and they've done it so many times.
Let me add also, about 40,000 Americans a year go to Cuba, violating this crazy law that says you can't go to Cuba. I mean, on what grounds that law exists, but and the Bush threat, I think he tried to toughen up the law, or try to prosecute a couple of people, which is absurd. But you know, if you fly to Mexico, you can fly into Cuba. The Cubans are very sophisticated about it. They don't stamp your passport. They smile, bienvenida, señor, and you pay for everything in cash. And there's no record of your being there. And a lot of Americans go because they're curious about the place. They want to see Cuba. Pardon me? Yes, you have to take dollars. That's what they want. You don't get in without your dollars.
No credit cards.
No credit cards.
Use credit cards.
And you wouldn't want to use a credit card if you're doing it illegally. But like 40,000 Americans a year travel there illegally.
There's a big love affair going on between the Castros and Venezuela now. What's the name of the
Chavez?
Chavez.
Well, Chavez is providing a lot of the oil that Soviet Union
providing. And of course, he's quasi-communist now, or at least socialist. And so he's featured on Cuban TV all the time as the good guy. No. We went on a tour through a cigar factory, so they do.
Yeah.
Oh, Ellie's brother said, bring back two boxes, and he's very specific what kind. And I said, I don't smoke, and I don't want. He said, no, it's okay, it's perfectly legal. So I went on the internet, and it's a year in jail and a $10,000 fine. Which was wonderful because I had a ready-made excuse to keep peace in the family.
Can I make just a postscript to that? I'm a sometimes cigar smoker and have been for years, so I do know a little bit of the history. when Batista left office, all of the tobacco growers, or a lot of them, left the country and took seeds with them. And they went to the Dominican Republic, right, Nicaragua. And today, the best cigars in the world are made in those countries. And the Cuban cigar has fallen into somewhat of a disrepute. I heard one recently. It was awful. It just is the machinery and everything isn't up to date, and it's a shame. But they still have the reputation, but not the product.
And the prices are incredible, are terrible.
I'm surprised to hear that, Don, because when they took us on their tour, they emphasized over and over again the quality control and the skill. And you have to work for so many years, and it's a handmade thing. So it's the individual worker's skill. But I guess that's not doing the trick.
But again, the problem may be that there's no incentive for these workers, you know. There's no work incentive. I was going to tell one story about this problem of Cuba's no longer having really a work ethic. And on the Mario boat crisis in the early 80s, I was living in New York, and Sandra and I were living there, and we were friends with the Cubaner and his French wife, and ran a little shop in the bottom floor of our apartment building. And he told us about when the Cubans, when Fidel basically entered in the same asylums and the jails and sent them all in the boats to, you know, Miami, along with some dissenters and stuff. Somehow a young guy, a young Cuban, and there are other people, you know, normal people went out as well. And anyhow, they volunteered to take in a Cuban refugee, and they brought him up from Miami, and they had a small apartment in our building. I think he slept on the couch in his one-bedroom apartment. And he said, I'm so disgusted. He said, after a few weeks, I had to throw him out. I said, I got him three different jobs, and they were not great jobs, working at McDonald's, whatever, just at some place to bring him some money. He lost all of them. He'd get up late every morning, wander out, you know, and he said, they don't know how to work anymore in Cuba, you know. He said, they don't have to. They get some food stuff, you know. And so I think there's something to that. You know, after 50 years of not getting any incentive, you eat whether you work or not, whether you show up, you know. And so, yeah, I think it probably, and the ones who are hustling are the people in the tourism industry. Because those are the ambitious ones, and they get money, and they try to, like the guy and people, you know, the cab driver. I don't think they counted, but they ask you, I think.
They didn't count or ask in our case. But we were told to have, I think it was the equivalent of $20 to get out. It was a head tax to get out. And if you didn't have that, you might not get out.
Yeah.
They do have bookstores, because I decided at one point, I was trying to practice my rusty Spanish whenever I could, and I decided I would try to buy one of those little phrase books. So I found a bookstore easily, but they had you know, bilingual dictionaries, but they were great big things that you couldn't. I know.
I wanted to add something too about this dual economy that exists. It's a strange thing. There are dollar stores, and you know, you can. I'm sure just any Cuban will
understand. That's strange. They now have what they call CUCs. CUC, and it's Cuban Universal, I don't know what it means. It's probably a Spanish thing. But the tourists spend CUCs, and they're called pesos, but they're not the same. So everybody calls them CUCs because it's confusing.
So you don't use your dollar then?
If you want to, you can. But what you're told to do is to change your dollars for CUCs.
But what I'm getting at is that they have, you know, the average Cuban store has very little in it. You go into a department store and it's empty shelves and stuff. But there are, maybe it's not fair, but I think there are stores where you need dollars to buy things. And these are like where they have like stereo sets and things like that, really higher quality stuff. Not the greatest stuff you would see here, but really, you know, the kind of things that require some purchasing power. And then Cubans would have these dollars. Now, before it used to be they got money from their relatives in Miami. They're the only ones that could do this. But now the people working in the industry, tourism industry can buy these, go into these stores, and I think they probably still exist because it's hard, you have to have dollars to buy these things. But I remember this concern about the dual economy, sometimes it'd be crazy. Like we went one time we're going to go to a Chinese restaurant, and we were told, no, that's not for foreigners, that's just for the local people, because the prices were like, it would have been like 25 cents for us to eat there, you know. I mean, the Cuban peso, it was nothing. One time, one evening when it was hot out, we were wandering around, we came into this leafy, large plaza, and it was a long line of people lining up, and I said, what's going on? Oh, we're buying ice cream. I said, let's get some ice cream. So they stand in line, after a few minutes, somebody comes up and taps me on the shoulder, Senor, are you a foreigner? And I said, yeah. He said, you're not allowed to buy ice cream in this land. This is only for the Cubans, because it was going to be like for nothing, right?
We saw ice cream lines, too.
Yeah. There aren't too many movie theaters around either, I don't think, are there? I don't remember. I think they all that costs money to bring in, you know, things like that, you know, so.
Do you ever get your ice cream?
Pardon? Pardon?
Do you ever get your ice cream?
Nope.
I'm curious, there's a lot of people.
I don't know.
I'm not aware of any.
They would isolate people to AIDS. But now, you know, I don't know what's going on, but prostitution is there, you know. It's just, these women will present themselves at any opportunity. But under the Tisza, it was so open, the streets were filled with prostitutes. You don't see that here. It's much more subtle.
No. Well, I think if you brought in a satellite receiver, you'd probably be arrested as a spy. But they didn't inspect our luggage. But I wouldn't fool around. They mean business. If they have the slightest suspicion that you're threatening the information barrier that they have thrown up, they'll land on you with both feet.
Well, yeah, I oh, no. That's a good point. Now, you see, Canada's very involved in the tourism industry, but I don't know about pharmaceuticals.
I didn't see what pharmaceuticals they have on the shelf, so I don't know where they originated. I think maybe the problem is they don't have the hard currency to purchase pharmaceuticals from the Western world, but that's just my guess.
Yeah, and they blame that all on the U.S. embargo. But as I said in a counter ad with this vendor, when I asked her, why don't you just import it from England or Italy, and she, you know, was like, she never thought of it, because they are bombarded constantly with propaganda. You know, there's no debate or no discussion on these things. It's brainwashing, man. Classic brainwashing.
I think all the questions. Oh, we're all going to, every minute's mandatory. We're going to Tropicana Cuban Restaurant. It's at on Cattleman, immediately north of Fruitville. And you go north on Cattleman, and you turn right and go through the gas station.
Across
the what? Yeah, the old dog problem. But I guess we'll wrap up. I just want to say, Monty's right. They love baseball. I went there during the Cuban World Series, and it was on television every night, and everybody was talking about it. And so I watched the games on TV. And between innings, they do salsa dancing in the stands. And I love the Cuban people. I like the food. And if I could, I'd go back again.
Yeah. All right.